Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News, and we're continuing our in-depth analysis of last night's debate, the remaining 4 weeks of this tumultuous campaign and beyond. And as our guests join us this hour, I'd like you to think about something that's been raised given the bitterness of this campaign, and we saw that on display last night in the debate. If your candidate does not win on November 8th, can you personally accept the outcome of the election and give the new president your support or at least the benefit of the doubt in their initial months in office? So I want to hear from you this morning on how you will see the outcome of the election, no matter if Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump wins. I want to know if you can give the new president, whoever that person is, the benefit of the doubt for the initial months of their presidency. And you'll know why I'm asking about this as our conversation begins, but I'd love to hear your thoughts. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter at Carrie NPR, Steph Curtis hanging out at nprnews.org/live. Ken Rudin is with us. He's the political junkie, of course, and with us from the Washington, D.C. area. Ken, good to have you back.
Thanks, Carrie. By the way, if I were president, you would be in jail by now.
Thanks a lot. What have I done? What have I ever done to deserve that from you, Ken?
You probably watched the debate last night like I did. That's what you did.
I did. Kathleen Hall Jameson is with us. She's a professor of communications at the University of Pennsylvania. And welcome back, Kathleen. Good to have you here.
Good to be with you.
What do you think? Ken's going to put me in jail if if he's elected president. Luckily, he won't be. We know that. Go ahead.
One of the interesting things about the debate last night was that that possibility was actually raised.
I know. I thought, Kathleen, that I said this in our 9 o'clock discussion, that that was one of the like open gasping moments for me of a debate that was really polarizing and bitter.
Well, one of the questions you ask about a candidate for president is, how will you use the extensive powers of the presidency? We have had serious overreaching in the past. Remember Nixon's enemies list, for example. And you want not only to ask, what are the issue distinctions, what are the similarities, but also, what are the temperaments, habits of mind, and dispositions to use power? That was the troubling moment.
Ken, what did that reveal to you?
It did. I mean, I agree with Kathleen completely. It was just like one of those jaw-dropping, like non-blinking response. I just sat there and said, he really said that, along with the stuff that you have hate in your heart and that you'd be in jail and the things he said about so many different things. And, of course, the fact that we went into the debate with 48 hours of nonstop coverage of the leaked, lewd 2005 tape with him and Billy Bush, talking about, I mean, things beyond the thought of a presidential candidate ever saying that. Can I just change the subject for one quick second, Carrie? Because what you asked in the beginning of the show is very, very telling. It's a great question. I'm thinking of 2000, the night of the 2000, when Al Gore finally conceded, he gave a very magnanimous speech.
That's right.
about healing the country. George W. Bush followed with an equally magnanimous speech. And look, the country was split down the middle in 2000. The Supreme Court was split down the middle in 2000. Those were very instructive ways of responding to what the Supreme Court decided. And when Donald Trump says that he urges his supporters, go out and vote, but then go to different precincts, and you know which precincts I mean, because they're going to steal this election from us. When you start putting those doubts in voters' minds about the sanctity of the system, the sanctity of the process, you just bring out a situation in the country that's just intolerable.
I think we have a caller who wants to follow up on that, Ken, to Jason in Forest Lake. Hi, Jason. What do you want to say about that?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It just feels like Donald Trump is running sort of a scorched earth campaign, and that, I kind of feel like he wouldn't care if he loses the election if his supporters went out and rioted at the end of this. And I think there's some very disturbing things that he said on the campaign. One of the more disturbing ones was insinuating that her security guard, if they gave up their weapons, let's just see what would happen to Hillary Clinton. That's one step away from calling for, you know, an assassination.
Yeah, you know, Jason, and I think you've alluded to something else that I wanted to bring up with Kathleen here. Some of the things that he said last night, Kathleen, about, you know, she claims she won the primaries, but, you know, let's ask Bernie Sanders about. He's again coming into this rigged election idea, and I think planting doubts in voters' minds about the outcome of this election.
And one of the things that we need to remember about the way our system works is it works on public trust and confidence in institutions. It works on the belief that people in offices that represent us and institutions that are part of our governmental system will act within the governmental constraints set up by our Constitution. Remember when the Supreme Court told Nixon he had to turn over the tapes? He had an option. He could have gone out into the White House lawn and burned them. He turned over the tapes. The acknowledgement that there are limits to power and that people who are in governance will act within those limits is something that we need to think carefully about as people, for example, ask whether or not we ought to change the libel laws in order to be able to go after journalists who've written things that are unfavorable.
You know, Ken, I would have loved a question, and maybe there's still time for this in the debate, exactly how Kathleen just put that. Your acknowledgement of the limits of your power and your willingness to accept what a majority of the voters say without casting into doubt the sanctity of elections. I mean,
well, look at the way Donald Trump put that issue about the special prosecutor.
Right.
He said, I would instruct my attorney general to appoint a special prosecutor, and ending that conversation by saying you'd be in jail. Now, anybody who understands what a special prosecutor does, you don't appoint you don't have your attorney general do that. You bring out the facts and things, but this is preordained. It is, and I've seen this mentioned many times last night, this is the words of a head of a banana republic who decides that, you know, we're the winners, and therefore you guys, you losers, are either in prison or worse. Jason mentioned about the Secret Service protection, laying down their weapons when Donald Trump earlier said that maybe the Second Amendment people can have some say in this. This is just beyond.
Kathleen, how much of Donald Trump's supporters' willingness to follow along when he calls into question the trust of the system is he displays a contempt for it, and a lot of Americans simply don't trust the process anyway. The trust for government is greatly diminished over the last 10 years or so.
The trust in all of our institutions, with very few exceptions, has diminished. We still have high confidence in the military, in the CDC, which is good because we need to make sure we can rely on health information. But even confidence in the Supreme Court has eroded somewhat. And so we live in a time in which a Trump-like candidacy was probably inevitable, because trust in so many of the institutions that stabilize our confidence in the way in which things work has been eroded. And one of the questions we have to ask in the long term is, how do you rebuild that trust? Because in the absence of it, our system of government doesn't work well. The accountability functions of the press, for example, can't work well if the trustworthiness of the press is called into question. And when the press doesn't behave as well as it ought to, it invites the perception that perhaps it shouldn't be trusted.
Right.
And so there's a broader context here. And the thing that I think is important to remember is there are people who would like to vote for the ideology that Donald Trump espouses on specific kinds of issues. So, for example, they would like to see the Supreme Court move in a certain direction. And they believe many of the things that he believes, in that they think there's something wrong with the system and change is needed. But he may not be the vessel through which they want to express that. They don't see an alternative right now. And so we're in a difficult situation in which those people are looking for a way to cast a vote, but also to say, I hope, Donald Trump, you are not going to do some of the things you say you're going to do and act in some of the ways that you're going to act. And they're saying that in a context in which they don't see a viable choice. That speaks to a political process that didn't serve up alternatives that have made the public very happy this year.
Here's the question, as you listen to the conversation here about the debate, the campaign, and beyond with Ken Rudin and Kathleen Hall Jamison. I'm asking you to think about, if your candidate does not win on Election Day, whether you're willing to accept the outcome of the election and give the new president your support, or at the least of it, the benefit of the doubt for the first couple of months of their presidency, to wait and see what happens. Are you willing to do that? Will you see the outcome of this election somewhat as illegitimate if your candidate doesn't win? 800-242-2828, 651-227, 6000 to the phones to Joe in Minneapolis. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton, but I think no matter who wins, there'll be a stalemate. Nothing will get done in the next 4 years. It's been so polarizing. And I have to put the blame on the Republicans, because going back to 1981 with Reagan's first inaugural speech that government is not the solution, it's the problem. For the last 35 years, all the Republicans have been doing is bashing government. And this is what you get. You get a problematic candidate who's basically, you know, is vile and debasing the whole system. And unfortunately, no matter who gets elected, yes, you'll support the president, but nothing will get done.
Ken, to Joe's first point about just more political gridlock, some things depend on that, right? Like what happens with the Senate, what happens with the House?
Oh, sure. And even if you have control, I mean, first, I was about to say, even if one party has control of the Senate, no party ever has control of the Senate, because unless you have 60 plus votes, the minority can stalemate and hold up actions and confirmations, bills, things like that. Although even when President Obama had 60 votes in the first 2 years of his presidency, 60 Democrats in the Senate, so many things didn't get done because so many Democrats, for example, had their own ideas about affordable health care, and they just didn't get along with everybody, didn't agree with everybody. But you're absolutely right. And I think one of the reasons you see so many Republicans, like the Koch brothers, like the Bush brothers and the Bush family, so many people say, well, look, you know, we may not win this presidential election. We may not be able to stop Hillary Clinton. But if there's anything we should do and can do is to make sure we have Republican control of the House and Senate, because otherwise it could very well become a blank slate, you know, opportunity for Hillary Clinton to just run the board with control of the executive and Congress.
A call here from Kenny in St. Paul. Kenny, how are you thinking about that question I've asked?
Hi, yeah. I think with a lot of the things that have been raised with the voter registration laws and voter ID laws, we've seen a lot of evidence that there's not really problems for illegitimacy in our elections, so I'm not really worried about that. If Donald Trump gets elected, it will be a legitimate election and he won, even if it's disappointing to me or to a lot of other people. The thing that I'm more concerned about is 8 years ago we had Republicans who basically pledged that this person got elected and we're not going to support anything they do. We're going to block everything they do. 4 years later, they made a similar pledge and saying we're going to get rid of everything he did. So my bigger question is for our people that aren't going to get elected or might not win is, if you don't win, how are you going to make it so that your party doesn't just lead to another 4 years of inaction? You know, what are you going to do to not, you know, believe that it's a legitimate election, but to work with the other people and actually do things and accomplish things?
Yeah, Kathleen, I think we're hearing some real anxiety here among our callers and among voters about the last 8 years looking like the next four.
And one of the things I think we need to ask is, where are there signs of hope inside the system? Because otherwise, I think we go into a dark room and beat our heads against the wall. There are areas in which Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton agree. They, for example, agree that we need a substantial investment in infrastructure. We do. That should be an agenda item that Democrats and Republicans can come together on, regardless of who is the president, and act. They agree that we should not sign on to the Trans-Pacific Partnership in its current form. Okay, what are the alternatives? Once we agree that we don't want to do something, are there forms of agreement on what we ought to do? So we should be able to say, let's listen to the vice presidential debate, and where were the areas of commonality there? They agreed that community policing works. As a result, is there common ground in ways to enhance community policing in order to address some of the problems that we have? And there's one other reason that I think there is some prospect for hope in the future. There are many people on both the Democratic and Republican side who are people of goodwill and integrity, and voters are able to vote down ballot on them regardless of party. So, for example, Rob Portman in Ohio is running substantially ahead of Donald Trump. It looks as if he's going to be reelected. He is a Republican who works well across the aisles. He's a person of goodwill and integrity. And the question is, can Democrats look at his record and say, yes, I'm proud to have him in the Senate. Maybe even I would vote for him under some circumstances. And can we say the same about a Democrat who is in the same kind of situation? To the extent that we tar everyone with dysfunction, we're being unfair to those people who have made efforts to try to make the system work. And in fairness, when we vote down ballot, we ought to ask, what have you done? How have you acted? Have you tried to find points of principled compromise? And if you have, regardless of what I'm doing top ballot, I'm going to give you a serious look because that's what I want in governance.
I don't think we can deny.
I don't think we can deny
what Kathleen says, but I can hear listeners saying, what about the Republicans who declared like 3 months into President Obama's tenure that they wanted to make him a one-term president?
Sure, that's true, but what about let me tell the contrary to what Kathleen just said.
Okay.
What about Republicans like Mark Kirk in Illinois, who has always worked across party lines? Of course, he had a very vulnerable House district. Now he's a senator in overwhelmingly Democratic Illinois. What about all his efforts to work across the aisle? And yet, he's the number one Democratic target. What about Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, who has given up, who has been long known to be a pro NRA Republican, who has worked very hard to get a compromise on sensible gun laws, but the Democrats are doing everything they can to knock him out. So, look, I understand what partisan politics is all about, but to say that, well, maybe the voters will reward candidates who try to reach across party lines, that just doesn't happen. It's true about Rob Portman in Illinois because he's a very good candidate, a very smart candidate, but the Mark Kirks and the Pat Toomeys of the world who try to work out compromises, just like on the Democratic side, too. There used to be there are Democrats all the time who try to talk across party lines, mm-hmm. but when they do, they're considered sellouts and they betrayers of progressive politics. So both sides are very intolerant.
Kathleen, how about that?
I'm not talking about what people do or parties do, but rather what we as voters should do. We have agency. Every one of us gets to go into a voting booth or pick up that absentee ballot and cast a vote. And as we ask, what kind of politics do we want? I hope we are able to look past party and ideology to ask, what have they actually done when they've governed? And to the extent that you assume everyone on the other side is disqualified by being on the other side, then there's no point in people behaving differently once they come into office, because there's not going to be any reward for the kinds of activities that might yield productive compromise, principled compromise, that does improve our well-being as a body politic.
Conversation about what the country and the government and the presidency and Congress looks like on the other side of this election, and I wanted to raise that because that was a pretty bitter debate last night, and we're all going to have to accept the outcome of this election a month from tomorrow. And I want to know how you're thinking about whether, if your candidate wins or not, whether you can personally accept the outcome of the election and give the new president the benefit of the doubt. From Dave here on Twitter, I cannot. I think we have enough evidence by now to know how each candidate would govern. Steph, off the page.
Rick says, if my candidate doesn't win, I'll acknowledge that the other candidate has won. I'll have to trust that the balances in place will prevent any overt silliness and nastiness, and I'll be resigned to the fact that nothing will get done. I'm not so unhinged as to think that if my party loses, it's the end of the world.
On Twitter, literally every other year, the answer would be yes. Donald Trump has lost any respect I may have had for him. To the phones to Dana in St. Paul. Hi, good morning. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning. So here we are. And after last night, I feel like I have an emotional hangover. My 14-year-old daughter, this is the first debate she's watched, and I was watching her. And when Donald Trump spoke or attacked, she was cringing. Her body was physically cringing on the sofa. And I realized it makes me sad that millions of people agree with Trump. And were he to win, that thought actually makes me sad. And I realize I don't have control over the outcome mm-hmm. of the election, but I have got to resolve. I interact at Cubs Food or at the post office with people who support Trump. I've got to resolve to be a better person. That when you apologize, that means you understand what you did and you're going to change. And Trump is giving us an example of someone who does not understand what he did. It's not locker room banter. He's 59. He doesn't understand what he did, and his apology is shallow. If that is our president, I have got to resolve to be a better person, and because that is the only thing
I get the sense that's going to be a
control over.
Sounds like it'll be a struggle, Dana. Kathleen, Dana actually raised something that I've been thinking about, which is if this is the first election that you, as even somebody who can't vote yet, but as a young person who has awareness of it, I cringe from that too. I just, oh my gosh, do you have some insight on that?
We've had previous elections that were like this.
We have.
We've had in the 1968 election, for example, you had people who looked at the major party nominees and said, "I do not see a candidate I can in good conscience support, and yet I have to vote." And that was an election in which, at the very end of the election in October, Hubert Humphrey broke with Lyndon Johnson over the war, which made it possible for some of those Democrats who were not otherwise going to support him to cast that vote. But some of those stayed home. Those were the McCarthy and Kennedy supporters in that year. So we've had past years in which people have looked at the choices and said, "I would really like to just vote for another election." And we've survived those moments. We've survived impeachment. We have survived a presidential resignation. The country is, in fact, very durable. If you go back to 1968, we had riots in the streets of the cities. I remember trying to get out of one of our nation's major cities that was under curfew as I was trying to get to another part of the United States. Wow. So we haven't, now many of the people who are in this young electorate have only learned that as history. But to the extent that 1968 was a year in which people believed on one side that we were in the midst of an immoral war and they saw no candidate who was going to get us out. On the other side, that there were ways to get us out of the war, but they couldn't be revealed because the electorate wouldn't support the candidacy of someone who actually made those kinds of statements. And you had multiple assassinations that year of leaders that people identified with.
That's true.
I would argue that 68 was in many ways a more troubling year. We did not, under those circumstances, foresee Watergate, but do remember that we have taken a president out of office for unconstitutional behavior. And so the country managed to survive that. And as people say, this is a year that's unprecedented, I go back to 68 and I say, well, compared to 68, this isn't a great year, but we've weathered some difficult times in the past.
Can I hear Kathleen on the political polarization. I think I was thinking more about the moral degradation, just the terrible quality of the political debate. That's what makes me cringe on behalf of young voters.
Well, I cringe on behalf of myself as well. I mean, I listened to what Dana said and her 14-year-old daughter, and it's so sad that she had to go through that 90 minutes last night. It's so sad that I had to go and you had to go through that 90 minutes because having covered these elections for so many decades and seen rogues and demagogues and scoundrels before, but I've never seen such nastiness. I mean, Kathleen goes back to 1968. You don't even have to go back that far. Go back to 2000. There are many Democrats who feel that the election was stolen
by
the Supreme Court, that Al Gore got more votes and yet he lost the election, that somehow Ralph Nader cost him the election. We could talk about that some other time. But the point is, there were a lot of people for the longest time who felt that George W. Bush was an illegitimate president. I mean, there's no question about that. So, yes, the choice in 68 may have been awful, but in 2000, look, I don't think George W. Bush was a mean candidate. He was a compassionate conservative, or at least he ran as a compassionate conservative. He didn't have those personal attacks on Clinton or Gore that we're seeing now with Donald Trump, and yet there were so many people who felt Bush was illegitimate. I fear that given his contempt for civility, given his contempt, the comments he made about women and disabled and Muslims and Latinos and Latinas and all that, this is just, in many ways, it's more frightening than 1968, and because it's coming from our leadership. You know, we talked about confidence in our system.
Mm-hmm.
What we haven't mentioned yet, we see some kind of evidence that the Russians are not only hacking into our emails, but hacking into voting systems in some states around the country. If we suddenly realize that this whole thing is a farce, that there is no reliability and the sanctity of the ballot box, then we are in far worse shape than we were in 1968.
Ken, are you really saying that you're not going to have confidence in the outcome of the vote because you're concerned that the Russians are hacking into voters?
No, No. I do.
I want to make clear what we're saying here.
No, I absolutely do. I'm just saying that there are so many things going on that between private conversations, and I mean that on both sides of the aisle, and hacked emails, and indications that the Russians are trying to hack into the voting systems in Illinois and Arizona, and you wonder if will your vote count? And of course, whoever loses, those suspicions will be, you know, this election does not end on November 8th.
Cookie says on Twitter, to your question, no. If Trump somehow won, I would presume that the election had been hacked and not trust the results. Ray says, if by some fluke Trump gets elected, I promise to give him all of the support and trust that Republicans gave Obama. To the phones to Deborah in Minneapolis. Hey, Deborah. Hi.
Hi. I wonder if there's any way to force Trump to step down. What would that process be? Or is there any way to, like, postpone the election? It seems like everybody's throwing their hands up and saying, we can't do anything about it.
Oh, more months of this, yes, to postpone it. Kathleen, what's your take on that?
No, after last night's performance, there's now sufficient Republican support for letting this candidacy go forward, that the extraordinary means that would have been required to remove him from the top of the ballot are not going to take place. And the difficulty, if they were, is that people have already cast votes. There are real legal problems in trying to make a switch because, in essence, you disenfranchise those individuals.
But Kathleen, how do you remove anybody from the top of the ticket? That's never happened, nor can it happen. The rules, as far as I understand it, is that if Donald Trump wanted to step down, that would be one thing, like Tom Eagleton did in 72. But if Donald Trump says, I'm not leaving the ticket, there's no mechanism in the RNC or anywhere to replace him as a candidate.
No, the scenario would require that his family goes to him and says, you're killing the family brand, you're killing the family business, and you're going to lose. Please step down. But there was a plausible scenario through some of the weekend in which those kinds of forces might be brought to bear. There was a collective sense that many people were holding their breath and waiting to see the debate performance. What Donald Trump managed to do in the debate was mobilize the constituency that is his core constituency to the extent that the hemorrhaging has stopped and those calls are now falling silent. In the absence of that, there will not be pressure on Donald Trump to step down. And you're correct. As best I read the rules, he would have to make that decision.
Ken?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, that's exactly it. But I also agree with Kathleen completely that we were all watching. We saw John McCain and Kelly Ayotte and Mark Kirk and so many Republicans saying either you have to step down or I cannot vote for you. And one would expect, but I thought it was very interesting that the beginning of the debate, all I could think of was that 2005 unbelievably disgusting tape. And the way when the debate ended, somehow I said, why can't Hillary Clinton answer a question about her email servers? So it felt like I don't know if he dodged a bullet. I don't know if the debate turned out to be more important than this tape. But I agree with Kathleen. I think he certainly survived. And his core following just feels there's absolutely no reason for him to
I think
to
you
give
were
up.
Just distracted by the newest shiny object there, Ken. You know, it was the debate. I mean, first, all the dramas around the tape. And then all we're talking about is the debate. And then it will be the next thing that comes out.
Absolutely.
That's why I think when I hear listeners say, you know, they feel like they have an emotional hangover, I feel like thinking of 30 more days of this kind of stuff is draining. It's just exhausting. And I love the political seasons. How do you two feel?
Well, you know, I don't know, anybody who follows me on Facebook knows that I put a picture of a cartoon character putting a knife to his chest yesterday. Today, there's a sign that people have been posting. I posted this, says, Meteor 2016, let's end it now. I mean, I just the thought of another month of this is just beyond. Have that meteor hit us now, please.
Kathleen, how about you? How do you feel?
Depressed. This has been a difficult election season, and the underlying problem is that in a context in which we have very, very real international, national, domestic program needs that need to be solved, we do not appear at the presidential level to have a rhetoric that is building an audience receptivity to problem solving. I do think, however, that the Republican reaction over the weekend set up a number of individuals of stature who are likely to be elected to the Senate and the House who are publicly breaking from the Trump nomination, and as a result, potentially act as a constraint on any of his tendencies as president that might be problematic. I don't think you're going to see party line support for a Trump presidency if Trump becomes the president of the United States. I think you're going to see the Paul Ryan agenda on the House become the Republican effort to try to rescope the domestic agenda of Donald Trump, and a strong signal to him that if you sign on to it, we will pass it, and we will blunt the other things that you are going to try to do that we consider to be excessive in the name of the party and the party's ideology. That's my best case scenario going forward for a possible Trump presidency in which many people will not feel the need to flee to Canada.
If you've just gotten in on the conversation, you've just heard Kathleen Hall Jamison talking about that from the University of Pennsylvania. Ken Rudin, the political junkie, is with us this hour. And I've been asking, again, if you're just joining, about if your candidate does not win, the candidate you support does not win on November 8th, can you personally accept the outcome of the election? Can you give the new president, whether it's Trump or Clinton, the benefit of the doubt in those early months? Let them try to enact and their agenda and bring the country along with them. Can you do that? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Steph, off the page.
Yeah, at nprnews.org/live, Steve wrote, "I agree with your guests, Carrie. We must get back to mutual respect and find the middle ground on topics that we can agree on. I'm a registered Republican and will not vote for Trump. His ego is too big for the White House. I am ready for a third party, and I don't have time to write more letters to my representatives, and I'm very tired of all the stalemate."
Cheryl on Twitter, "No, I can't imagine that Trump will win, but if by some horrible act of fate he does, I will not support him, period. Juliet, no. I'd have a hard time if the candidate I'm voting for wins. Choosing the lesser of two evils from my eyes, this election is insane." To Jim in Eagan. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, I'm just wondering why more attention hasn't been paid to election reform this year in the way of instant runoff voting or ranked choice voting. Hmm. I mean, I know the experts say that those, you know, that form will not, wouldn't change the outcome of the election, but I'm okay with that as long as, no matter who wins, as long as I know that I would be able to vote my conscience.
So Jim, I'm a little short on time here. So voter reform here we're talking about, and I will tell Jim and others that we've done several shows on that, and you can find that on the podcast NPR News with Carrie Miller at iTunes or wherever. Ken, I think that's a good suggestion, though, that Jim has here. Should we be paying more attention to some kind of election reform to address some of these things that we're upset about?
Well, it's certainly not going to happen in the middle of an election, and it certainly won't happen if both sides remain as apart after this election as they have been for the last, you know, I mean, given the fact that the battles between the Republican Congress and the Democratic president. But, you know, also what drives a lot of Republicans nuts is the fact that Donald Trump, in the beginning, with 15, 16 opponents, he would win these primaries
That's
and
right.
caucuses with 28% of the vote, 30% of the vote, which means that 70% of the Republican Party was against him. But Donald Trump would said, look, whoever comes in first gets the marbles, and especially in many of these winner-take-all states. So maybe the Republican Party, I don't know if the Democratic Party needs it as much. Maybe the Democratic Party needs it with superdelegates. There are a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters who feel that the way the Democrats cast their nominee was not the right way to do it. And I'm sure there are a lot of Republicans who feel that anybody who wins with 28, 29% of the vote is not an inspiring choice either.
Kathleen, one of the shows that we did during the primary season was primary reform. And I remember one of our guests talking about, instead of these individual states and the way it's set up now and the outside influence that some of these states like Iowa that are not very diverse have, blocks of states coming together and more of kind of a mandate out of the primaries for whichever candidate emerges. Would that help in some ways?
Yeah, I've always favored regional primaries. I think they first have the benefit of involving more total voters right. in the process earlier. They also mean that we could address systematically the various kinds of economic understructures of different parts of the country, because there are different needs and there are different economic drivers depending on where you're located. And I do like rank order voting, because what it does is minimizes the likelihood that there's an advantage to engaging in polarizing rhetoric. It drives the candidates to try to find those people in the center to the extent that they still exist. And we get rid of, as a result, the tendency to automatically demonize another side.
Steph, off the page.
Joe says, yes, he can accept the other candidate. He says, because otherwise we are telling our fellow Americans that we have no faith in them and their ability to choose a president. And Jane says, no, I'm sorry, it's Peggy says, as a psychotherapist with over 40 years of experience, accepting Trump as president would require ignoring everything I know about character pathology. I would dread the ensuing 4 years and fear for our country.
I'm fearing for it, too, Ken, because I don't hear from many of our listeners about, rising to their better angels here and giving the president, whoever it is, a chance.
Let me add something, though.
Okay.
I wouldn't frame the question in terms of just an individual. One of the things we need to ask is, how much confidence do we have in the resilience of our structures of government? How much confidence do we have in the integrity of the people who are in our various branches? Now, you saw a whole lot of people in the national security establishment stand up during the primaries and say that if we were given an illegal order, one that violates the Geneva Accords, we would not follow that order. If you want to say that you are so desperately afraid of the election of one person, in the absence of those kinds of constraints, I think you have a different kind of scenario than you do in the presence of those kinds of constraints. We do have three branches. We do have constitutional underpinnings for them. The real place that a president has latitude is in international affairs, and that's the reason that there is some concern about a candidate who seems to lack impulse control.
Kathleen, always a pleasure, and I really do appreciate your calm, measured insight. Thanks so much.
That's my Minnesota background.
I gotcha. Ken, how about you?
Well, you know something that's interesting. We're less than a month away. We're just over 4 weeks away. This is the time when, if you think, no matter who's running, that the nation should be filled with hope, that there's good things, there's going to be change or continuation, whatever it is, but you're filled with hope because there's always something exciting about an election. I have never, ever, ever seen so much dread, regardless right. who wins. I mean, whatever I feel about Clinton or Trump, the polls show they are the most polarizing, most unpopular, the poll numbers, talk about deplorables. I mean, these are the most deplorable running mates, according to the polls, in history. And the fact that, sure, we're partisan, we're torn over the Vietnam War in 68, and we're torn over a split Supreme Court in 2000, but the anger, the vitriol, the pitting of one group against another, I have never, ever seen it from a major party candidate. And I don't know if the answer after the election is maybe just moving to New Jersey or some other foreign country, but it does. I go back to Dana and her 14-year-old daughter.
Yeah.
I am on that couch with them and just terrified and upset about what I see.
I will talk to you next Monday, Ken. Thank you, as always. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.